all in the same boat.
Blog Talk Radio.
And we're all going to catch the same cow from the same man. All of us have suffered here in this country political oppression at the hands of the white man, economic exploitation at the hands of the white man, and social degradation at the hands of the white man. Now, in speaking like this, doesn't mean that we're anti-white, but it doesn't mean we're anti-exploitation.
We can't go on pretending day by day, expect the moment somewhere to make a change. We all a part of God's saving family. And the truth, you know, love is all we need.
Relationships don't work between black people. Racism, white supremacy is the reason.
Absolutely.
Can't get a job in the hood and you educated. Racism, white supremacy.
Absolutely.
Can't get an education in the hood because it's expensive. Racism, white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Poor education in the hood you live in. Racism, white supremacy.
Absolutely.
You live next to poor people who will rob your ass, steal and kill your ass because they don't have no options, and they don't have no option to critically think. Racism, white supremacy.
Yeah.
And I see that that's a problem. So I wanted to just make a pimp decision.
$1 trillion plus. From L.A. to Miami. Minnesota to Detroit. Chicago. Alabama.
California, out of Oakland, Compton, LA. You can have $1 billion.
what you owe me, and you owe me $1 billion, so I want what's mine. I want to have the best of life. I want the sun to shine on me. I want my fellas to wake up. People of color all over the world is in the $1 billion flow. Maybe you in Atlanta, Georgia, maybe you in California, maybe you in Texas, maybe you in New York, maybe you in Florida, maybe you in Canada, but you in the $1 billion. Maybe you in St. Paul, Minnesota, Indianapolis, Indiana, which is about the $1 billion flow. It's going on up in New York and Chicago, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, New Orleans. It's going on, the $1 billion flow. Down in Texas, Arkansas, North Carolina, South Carolina, Phoenix, Las Vegas, New York. We're calling for the $1 billion flow. I see you to rise up and be brilliant. Down rich, because I'm in the $1 billion flow. I am the original man. I am the original woman. I must have my respect. I must have my education. I must have $1 billion. I must be rich. I must lift my brothers and sisters out of the ghetto and out of poverty. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Get what I want. Have what I want. I can get it now. Right now. Tell somebody I'm in the $1 billion flow. Look at somebody. I'm in the $1 billion flow on my child. I'm in the $1 billion flow in my business. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Why don't you get in the flow of the billionaire? The
chicken to produce a duck egg. Even though they
belong to the same family of fowl, so-called fowl. A chicken just doesn't have it within its system to produce a duck egg. It can't do it. It can only produce according to what that particular system was constructed to produce. The system of this country cannot produce freedom for an Afro-American. For this system, this economic system, this political system, this social system, this system, period, it is impossible for it as it stands to produce freedom right now for the black man in this country. It's impossible. And if ever a chicken did sure, you'd say that it was certainly a revolutionary.
Well, we're justified in seeking civil rights if it means equality of opportunity. Because all we're doing there is trying to collect on our investment. Our mothers and fathers invested sweat and blood. 310 years we worked in this country without a dime in return. I mean, without a dime in return. You let a white man walk around here talking about how rich this country is. But you never stop to think how it got rich so quick. It got rich, you made it rich. You think the people who are in this audience right now, they're poor, we're all poor, as individuals. Our weakness salary individually amounts to hardly anything. But if you take the salary of everyone in here collectively, it'll fill up a whole lot of wealth, a lot of wealth. If you can collect the wages of just these people right here for a year, you'll be rich, richer than rich. When you look at it like that, think how rich Uncle Sam had to become. Not for this handful, but millions of black people. You and my mother and father, who didn't want to need our share, but work from can't see in the morning until can't see at night. And work in the white man rich, making Uncle Sam rich. This is our investment. This is our contribution. Our blood. Not only did we give him our free labor, we gave him our blood. Every time he had a call to arms, we were the first ones in uniform. We died on every battlefield the white man had. We have made a greater sacrifice than anybody who's standing up in America today. We have made a greater contribution and have collected less. That's correct.
Show you their feet. and inflict a knife in your back when you turn around. You at least know what that man down there is doing, and you know how to deal with him. So all I say is this. This is all I say. But when you start talking about one, talk about the other. When you start worrying about the part or the piece, worry about the whole. And if this piece is no good, the entire pie is no good, because it all comes out of the same plate, and it's made up out of the same ingredients. Article number 2 of the Constitutional Amendments provides you the right to own a rank or a shotgun. Constitutionally legal to own a shotgun or a rifle. This doesn't mean trying to get a rifle and form a battalion, go out looking for white folks, although you be within your rights.
Of coke or what's that. I know too many of them. They're brand. Dean Napier, Mr. Bell, members of the faculty and members of the student body of this great institution of learning, ladies and gentlemen. Now, there are several things that one could talk about before such a large, concerned, and enlightened audience. There are so many problems facing our nation and our world that one could just take off anywhere. But today I would like to talk mainly about the race problem, since I'll have to rush right out and go to New York to talk about Vietnam tomorrow, and I've been talking about it a great deal this week and weeks before that. But I'd like to use as a subject from which to speak this afternoon the other America. And I use this subject because there are literally two Americas. One America is beautiful for situation. In a sense, this America is overflowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of opportunity. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, culture and education for their minds, freedom and human dignity for their spirits. In this America, millions of people experience every day the opportunity of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in all of their dimensions. And in this America, millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But tragically and unfortunately, there is another America. This other America has a daily ugliness about it that constantly transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions. They find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. In a sense, the greatest tragedy of this other America is what it does to little children. Little children in this other America are forced to grow up with clouds of inferiority forming every day in their little mental sky. As we look at this other America, we see it as an arena of blasted hopes and shattered dreams. Many people of various backgrounds live in this other America. Some are Mexican-Americans, some are Puerto Ricans, some are Indians, some happen to be from other groups. Millions of them are Appalachian whites. Probably the largest group in this other America in proportion to its size in the population is the American Negro. The American Negro finds himself living in a triple ghetto, a ghetto of race, a ghetto of poverty, a ghetto is to deal with this problem, to deal with this problem of the two Americas. We are seeking to make America one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Now let me say that the struggle for civil rights, the struggle to make these two Americas one America, is much more difficult today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. For about a decade or maybe 12 years, we struggled all across the South in glorious struggle to get rid of legal, overt segregation and all of the humiliation that surrounded that system of segregation. In a sense, this was a struggle for decency. We could not go to a lunch counter in so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We could not make use of public accommodation. Public transportation was segregated. Often we had to sit in the back and within transportation within cities, we often had to stand over empty seats because sections were reserved for whites only. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. The struggle was to deal with these problems. Certainly they were difficult problems. They were humiliating conditions. By the thousands, we protested these conditions. We made it clear that it was ultimately more honorable to accept jail cell experiences than to accept segregation and humiliation. By the thousands, students and adults decided to sit in at segregated lunch counters to protest conditions there. When they were sitting at those lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream, seeking to take the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy, which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle. 1964, Civil Rights Bill came into being after the Birmingham Movement, which did a great deal to subpoena the conscience of a large segment of the nation who appeared before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. After the Selma Movement in 1965, we were able to get a Voting Rights Bill. All of these things represented strife. But we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good college job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine quality integrated education a reality. So today, we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. Not merely a struggle against extremist behavior toward Negroes. And I'm convinced that many of the very people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. I came to see this in a very difficult and painful way in Chicago over the last year where I've lived and worked. Some of the people who came quickly to march with us in Selma and Birmingham were active around Chicago. And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes, rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. And I think this is what we got to see now, and this is what makes the struggle much more difficult. So as a result of all of this, we see many problems existing today that are growing more difficult. It's something that is often overlooked, that Negroes generally live and work from today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, things are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro's worse off today than he was 15 and 20 years ago. And so the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. But today the unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. And the
His influence would be so widespread that he would be the major influence in the fifth Pan-African Congress, one of the most important, Manchester, England, 1945, Nkrumah, George Padmore, Peter Abraham, Johnstone Kenyatta, who later became Jomo Kenyatta, people who would later become heads of state in Africa, influenced by the teachings of Marcus Garvey, and who would incorporate the teachings of Marcus Garvey into the structure of that nation. Nkrumah would have a Black Star Square, Black Star Line. Nkrumah's in Marcus Garvey's influence over Nkrumah was profound. Marcus Garvey's influence on the rest of Africa was equally profound. And had these states not been waylaid, imitating the parliamentary procedure of the West, it's never going to work in Africa. They could have brought great African territorial states into being as against these imitation European nation states that now exist in Africa. Too restrictive for the African character, too restrictive for African culture. The Europeans created the nation state with its tight borders and its selfishness. The African had the territorial state where a multiplicity of culture existed within one border with respect for all. And they did not begin a conflict one to the other until the European came and created that conflict. So-called tribal wars did not start in Africa until the coming of the European. They would put one against the other in order to conquer both. Every person that came into Africa did Africa a disservice. Earlier today, I was accused of Arab bashing in an interview over WNYC. I was saying that the Arab slave trade started 1,000 years before the European slave trade, and that it drained Africa so much time and energy and organization, the Africa did not have the organization and the energy to successfully resist the European slave trade. What Marcus Garvey was saying to us, in essence, is that I will make you a whole people again. I will heal the wounds of this 500 years of oppression. He would ask the question, where are your men of affairs? Where are your captains of industry? Having not found them, he began to try to make them. And restoring our confidence in ourselves, the confidence to rule whole nations. He would tell us, up you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. Now let's apply that to today, because you have a lot of fake independent states in Africa. How can a nation in Africa be independent when it is so dependent on the European? It does not even produce the state to pin the holiest child's diaper together. Don't even produce the toilet paper for his bathroom. Don't even produce his underwear. No nation of people so unproductive, so unimaginative that they don't even produce their underwear cannot call themselves free. We have to study the Liberian scheme. We must study the over $50,000 in equipment he had placed in Liberia before they told him in 1924 they wasn't going to let him settle. Steam shovels, people who could who could run brickyards, builders, architects, all the means of a nation, had he been permitted to settle in Liberia and cure the wounds of that sick nation, the African independence explosion would have occurred a generation before and would have been successful. This dreamer from Jamaica, who is still not understood in Jamaica or in the African world in total, need to be looked at again in context with our future. We might have to step back in order to move forward. We might have to resign ourselves to eating the food we produce, wearing the clothes that we made. We might understand that a nation means self-reliance. We might take an inventory and find out what goes into the making of a nation. We might start at the top and fulfill all those needs. If you're going to make a locomotive, sometime you might start by making a safety fence. And remember, other people in the world started with that. 200 years ago, the Japanese did not even have a good wheelbarrow. Look at them now. Someone challenged them. Someone challenged them to come out of the lethargy of that culture and meet the challenge of a changing world. The intelligence of a people can be measured by to what extent they adjust and understand the nature of change. We as a people are going to have to prove ourselves equal to the nature of change. And to prove yourself equal to the nature of change, you have to prove yourself equal to the nature of revolution. To realize revolution is not always killing people. Revolution is making a dramatic change in your own life and the life around you. Doing for yourself what you've been expecting other people to do for you. You cannot start but hoping to have a great mass around you. You can take the teachings of Marcus Garvey, especially his African fundamentals. You can look at the document compiled by Professor Hill. You can look at the work compiled by Professor Martin, Tony Martin, and other scholars who found different approaches to Marcus Garvey. You can make up your mind that you're going to have to stop being those small, selfish people worrying about petty sororities and fraternities and a whole lot of things, wasting your time. You're going to have to learn that everything that touches your life must contribute to your liberation or be thrown into the ash can of it. If you're going to start a revolution, I ask that you start with a mirror. You stand before that mirror, like what you see. Say to the person staring at you, you and I are going to change the world. We're not going to wait for a mob to join us. We're not going to wait for tomorrow, because we're going to start right now. Thank you.
62 tabs open and no idea if you'll be approved for a good credit card. Let you overcome uncertainty.
Thank you very much. There's a lot of things to be explained tonight, and we will need all of the time to explain it. Somewhere in the march of life, we've taken the wrong turn, and we've lost part of the definition of ourselves. At the heart of our struggle is to get back what slavery and colonialism took away. And the main thing they took away, not just nation, they took away a nation's frame of mind. Most people migrate through force or circumstances to other countries, take with them a nation frame of mind. They have demeaned Africa in the history of the world to such an extent that you're not only not proud as you need to be of an African nation, you have not retained an African frame of mind. And you long to be too many times those things most unlike yourself. And you feed grist and to other people's mills. Nothing comes out except what has been put in. Your mind has been programmed into escaping from Africa. Now it has to be reprogrammed to reclaim all Africa and to come into these with all the African people on the face of the earth. We have to stop answering to the word minority because we were never a minority. A minority. A frightened, insecure minority who may be less than 10% of the world's population. Through massive propaganda that made you assume that you were a minority. But 750 million Africans in Africa, and the count is always poor because it's probably more than that. But 300 million Africans in the Western world, but millions of Africans in India and the South Pacific Islands, we number over 1 billion people on the face of this earth. If you want to start building back a nation and self-reliance, every person of circumstance, every leader, every teacher, every preacher, every conscious African person must ask and answer the question, how will my people stay on this earth? You have to give priority to the question and the answer. Because once you answer the question, you will start building back what time, circumstances has taken away from you. If you say that my people must be educated, not trained by the oppressor, but educated. Because if you are truly educated, you wouldn't be beggars at the door of your oppressor. If you were educated, you would not only get back the nation, you'd get back the nation's frame of mind. That portable nation that you can carry with you wherever you are on the face of this earth. You must start with a mirror and like what you see. And once you say, I am an African person, whatever I am on the face face of this earth, I am first and foremost in union with other African people. I'm not talking away from the subject of self-reliance and development of the Marxist Garvey movement. I'm talking away from it in order to come to it so you can understand what I'm saying. I know where I am and the significance of where I am. I'm in the state of Virginia, the road mark for the American state. The panel of the American state mind, the political frame of mind in the Virginia colony shapes the destiny of this country. I'm in the state where slavery began in a formal sense, and where some of the fiercest revolutions against slavery started. I'm here to walk into on the state and on the ground where Nat Turner walked and rebelled. I'm here to communicate with the spirit of Denmark Beasley. And also to call your attention that Virginia was not only a great slave holding state, it was a slave breeding state. But everybody who wanted a slave had a slave. And the system became unwieldy. They started feeding them like horses. My great-grandmother spent 3 years roaming around Virginia looking for a lost husband who had been sold to a slave farm here in Virginia. Now, I maintain that getting on the ship in Africa, when these Africans took a piece of Africa's dirt, put in their mouths and looked back at their nation for the last time, that was the beginning of an African consciousness that will ultimately lead to Pan-Africanism. On those ships, there were Africans who had never met. There were Igbo, Yoruba, Akan people, different parts of Africa. But finally they realized one thing, in spite of the separation, they were all African, and they were all in the same boat. Now, if you understand what this means for today, you will stop separating yourself based on who's from a Caribbean island, who's from Georgia, and who's from Africa. Today, in the eyes of our enemies who hope to continue our oppression to aggrandize his economic status, he makes no distinction between who's in Africa, who's from a Caribbean island, who's from Georgia, AKA, don't make no distinction between who's a Delta, who's an AKA. The slave ships brought no Delta, brought no AKA. We were all Africans. The slave ship put the dump down in an island called Jamaica. They became Jamaica. Another one, the island called Barbados, they became Barbados. But the slave ships brought no Barbados, brought no Jamaica, brought no High Yala, no Low Yala. One piece. So we went through a process of bastardization when some people are confused about where they belong among us. Clarify this situation very easily. Your creator, the oppressor, has made no room in his house for you. You either belong among us or you don't belong any place. Now the whole concept of Africa returning could recover started on those ships when we understood the oneness of all of us, though we came from different regions in Africa. We had different systems of worship in Africa. We were all one oppressed African people. Once we regained that consciousness, we will stop playing the fool and we will unite. And the mere fact of union of more than a million people, just union itself, even before you buy a gun, organize an army, just the union itself will put you in the arena of world power. Because you began to ask the essential question about what has been taken away from you and how was your mind programmed into accepting, took away not only our history, they mutilated and declared war on our culture. They colonized history and information about history. Then the most disastrous of all colonization, which plagues us to this day, they colonized the image of God. They dared you to worship a God that looked like you. And you forgot, because you were not that well acquainted with your history, that we were the first people on this earth to create and accept a female God. We were the first people on the earth to accept the female as the head of the army, not the sendout, but the ruler, the leader of an army, and the leader of the state. First, pledged the insecure people of Europe because they grew up in a society where they fear the woman in power. We did not exercise this fear until we came in touch with Barnes, Bakers, and Booth. We did not understand the depth of our culture. We became confused. We became imitators of the culture of our oppressor. And we turned our back on too much. It was our culture. We forget something absolutely essential for today. That social agencies were created to take advantage of and to remove the defects in European culture. Why is it that when they came to Africa, not a single person got any information to the contrary, when they came to Africa, they found no insane asylum, because no one had ever gone insane. Found no office, but no one had ever thrown away children. Found no old people's home, because no one ever discarded grandma and grandpa. They found a basic humanity that we have to get back to understand. Well-ordered people, a culturally aware people, must take care of the very old, the very young, and the sick, and the needy. That was not done in Europe. So this is why they had poorhouses, and we had never heard of one. This is why they had orphanages, and we had never heard of one. This is why you had to preach humanity while we were living humanity. This is why you need to understand what St. Augustine meant when he starts appraising the conference at Nicaea, conference at Nicaea, 335 AD. He said, these are giving us a religion we had 3,000 years ago. If we had this religion 3,000 years ago, why did our concept last? Their concept last. They dogmatized it, formalized it, and propagandized it to the point you think this is the only way to be a Christian, is their way, which was better just before you knew that way. You did not say, I am my brother's keeper. Because if you have to say, I am my brother's keeper, I'm afraid you're trying to get out of keeping it. But if you're genuine about it, you just go ahead and keep it. They had to proclaim things that they wasn't too sure about. We have to dig deeper into our history and dig deeper into some great literature they have created about themselves that repudiates themselves. But can't we read the word Roman Africa and see how the Roman church, corrupt and in disarray, moved over into Europe at the Conference of Nicaea, and it came back to Africa, a crippled child of Africa's original. Why can't we see right now that our enemy has worn out the carbon copy of his original, if indeed he ever had any originality? Now what has this got to do with the subject? Everything to do with the subject. Because when people program you into dependency, you make peace with them instead of making peace with yourself, forming an alliance between yourself. If you wear shoes, why not make shoes? If you live in a brick house, why not own a brick yard? Now, what we're trying to get to is that Booker T. Washington taught self-reliance, and self-reliance relates to nationhood. But what we now need to do is to look back, see centuries, some of those giants, taller than the 20th century giants ever could be. Men more dynamic than Martin Luther King, and I have absolutely nothing against Martin Luther King. But the dynamic ministers of the 19th century, because early in the 19th century, the Africans discovered that the system of chattel slavery was about to be turned into a system of colonialism, a more sophisticated form of slavery. Slavery is never abolished. Slavery is transformed. Only the slave can free the slave. The first thing you have to do is to free the slave's mind from dependency on the oppressor. The Africans then understood that they had lost their land, they lost their place in human history. And the people who got them lost were the last branch of the human race to enter that arena called civilization. They began to have a romance with Rome and Greece. The Europeans don't seem to recognize right now that Europe did not create Rome and Greece. These were two Mediterranean-inspired nations. The challenge of Rome and Greece created Europe. Don't get mad, get smart. Prove me wrong. Do your reading. Prove me wrong. There wasn't an organized state in Europe until around 800 B.C. And that was two Mediterranean-inspired nations, inspired from North Africa, the Mediterranean Islands, and part of Western Asia. Europe had nothing to do with the creation of Rome and Greece. How is it now that every Scandinavian schoolboy whose nation didn't exist at the time can claim Rome and Greece as part of his heritage? And when you look at Nile Valley civilization that stretches 4,000 miles into the body of Africa, when you look at the Nile as a great culture highway bringing people from the south to the north, from the south, when we look at the rehearsal for Egyptian civilization, which is in the Sudan, Kush, or Nubia, civilization needs a rehearsal stage. Now, if European sailors, they built the pyramids, find some experimental pyramids in Europe where they were rehearsing on how to do it. But if you want to look at the rehearsal, go to the Sudan right now. You'll see those experimental pyramids. That's where the great show of African civilization was rehearsed. Went down the Nile Valley to listen to the Broadway of that day and put the show on the road. It was a Southern African show from the beginning. But when people began to take away your nationness, they want you to forget that you ever ran a nation and ran it well, exceptionally well. They want you to forget their own historian. They want you to forget Herodotus. And he said the tint of complexion of the Ethiopians and the Egyptians were basically the same. Let us conceive that Herodotus may not have been schooled in African custom of civilization, but let us conceive the fact that Herodotus had some good eyesight. This is an observation, not an analysis. So when I look at the Ethiopians, I look at the Egyptians, the color's basically the same. So what is that argument about somebody coming from outside of Africa, building one of the greatest enduring civilizations in history, then disappeared? Why would anybody be so nice to Africa? At the time, the early Egyptian civilization was being built. There was no functioning state in Europe. This was before the first European built a shoe, a house with a window. Why would he leave all that Iron Age, come all the way to Africa, build a great civilization, go back to Europe and live under the Iron Age for 2,000 years before he made a shoe? And when they encountered us, we had something they ended and had to destroy in order to be secure. They had to destroy the structure of the state. For 2,000 years, the assault came from Western Asia, now mistakenly called the Middle East. And for another 1,000 years, beginning with the destruction of Carthage during the Punic War, it came from Europe. This first massive European attack, Alexander, then the Romans, because the Europeans have a problem with mathematics, especially fractions. The Africans of that day was willing to share the trade of the Mediterranean with Europe, but the Europeans didn't want to share. Because they don't know how to one fourth, one half, so much for you, they say, oh, I'll take it all. And that's that problem right now at the door of a new form of slavery, and we don't stop it. They want to justify the recolonization of Africa, and they want to take it all. And you've got religions in Africa as the handmaiden of the new slavery, especially Islam. We have to make a separation between Islam and Arabism. We must make a separation between conservative Islam and revolutionary Islam.
Right.
Because in Arab Islam, no woman ever rose to state power. If anybody know me wrong, I'll stop and let them speak. Name in revolutionary Islam, Amina became head of the state of Zaire in Nigeria, protected the state, rode at the head of her army, and left the name in history. Also, in revolutionary Islam, Kohana stopped the southward spread of the Arabs and told her son to be Muslim for political reasons, because the Europeans became a Christian for political reasons. And he holds on to it for political reasons. And anytime he can't use it to hold his position in the world, he'll discard it. Because he never believed in it. Our democracy. Because it's not democratic. Right now, we are trapped between pan-capitalism and pan-Africanism. And if we go for pan-capitalism, we're volunteering ourselves into the new slavery. If we go for pan-Africanism, we will realize we have to rebuild the African states. We have to at least acknowledge what the Africans went wrong. They do not manage their wealth-producing resources. Until you manage the wealth-producing resources, until you control the land, you are not. You cannot, as in South Africa, foreigners control the gold, the diamond, the mine, and control 87% of the land. They had 87% of the land when Nelson Mandela came to power. They still have 87% of the land. Now you can move, go through Africa, make all kinds of speeches, and associate with all kinds of Africans who are mainly thugs and head of a state who destroyed the Africa that could be. And some of them destroyed the Africa that could be in the name of a religion that the Africans created and do not understand the nature of that creation. That's why we have no emphasis now on the law, Thabit and Harry, two great heroes of early Islam. No relationship with the Ethiopian period of Islam, when Ethiopia sheltered the early followers of the Prophet Muhammad. Until the difficulty blew over and they came back and built the state and ultimately turned on the very Africans who had supported them militarily. In John Jackson's book, Introduction to African Civilization, you should read the chapter called Africa and the Civilizing of Europe. And Eleanor Hoffman's book, Realm of the Evening Star, Morocco and the Land of the Moors, read the chapter called The Rape of Timbuktu. 1591, the North African Arab and Muslim turned on the Africans in the South and destroyed the last of the great independent states in West Africa and permitted the slave trade to spread inland. The Arabs were in the slave trade before Islam, and they're in the slave trade more than ever right now. Now, with some person supposedly representing us, dream of a great Islamic superpower, he frightened the hell out of me, because when I studied Europe under the domination of the Catholic Church before the Protestant Reformation, this was a form of white enslaving white. And when women spoke up to burn them as witches, sometimes because they failed to be witches, a man want to make it with a lady, you know, and she would give him a tumble, I declare you a witch. She wasn't a witch. She just refused to be a witch. Now, if today you think that the black women's liberation movement has to relate to the white women's liberation movement, you are reading history, misreading history. Because once she is free of the domination of the white man, she will join the white man in the oppression of you. You need a liberation movement far stronger and better than anything they've got. But when you restore what you have lost in your journey in the West, you have to ask some questions. We check out the deal of the culture unity of black Africa, dealing with the history of the matrilineal. He said he found no evidence for Africa abused women, and the highest tribute was paid to the mother. Even today, many Africans prostrate themselves at the door of their mother and will not rise until she said, rise, precious fruit of my womb, and accept my blessing. In an early African court, if you sentence a man to death, if his mother will not participate in his execution, you can't kill him no matter what he did. Because the woman who brought him into the world has the last word as to whether he should be taken out. Now you want to ask some questions of what we lost. You want to ask some questions here and now. Where did this black woman slapper came from? What if the abuser came from? You didn't do it in Africa. Why are you doing it here? You're imitating the worst traits of your enemy. You came out of a collective society. And when you were at your best in this collective society, you had the one thing you must regain first and foremost, high morality and collective discipline. You cannot lift a people from a lower to a higher level without morality and discipline. We did not come out of society for each individual to do his or her thing. Your thing has to relate to the collective thing of the entire people. Now, we brought some of this to the new world. We brought some of this to the farm here in Virginia and in Alabama. All sharecroppers in the whole valley, miles and miles, all sharecroppers. When it comes to taking that one's corn, all of them got together to get that one's corn in. Take that one's potatoes, all got together to take that one's potatoes. Not a nickel pass. And at the end of the day, the little brown lady who can do miracles in the kitchen put on a good pot, and there was no money exchanged. We gave to each other based on common need, because that's the kind of society we produce. And the Egyptian pharaoh preached this from a throne 1,300 years before the birth of Christ. He created the concept that Karl Marx later called communism and socialism. What I'm trying to get to is the propaganda of our oppressor, and using the Bible as propaganda made us think that we were God's stepchildren. And God has no stepchildren, because that is an ungodly act. God has no favored people, no chosen people. God will not choose one people over another, because that would make God a bigger. Nearly all religions do irreligious things in the name of their God. That demeans the concept of their God. Slavery came with the blessing of the church. It was rationalized with the blessings of the church.
God had placed some people outside of humanity. God will not place any people outside of humanity if God is love and God is just, because that would be an ungodly act. Even today, the rationalization for the recolonization of Africa started by Christians and conservative fundamentalist Arabs. Now, if you had the kind of Muslim superpower that Farrakhan dared to advocate, Adolf Hitler would look like a misbehaving schoolboy and the kind of murdering you see. And there's nothing in any religion that places their followers above other people. We must make a distinction between religion and what man imposes on religion, that is his custom. He imposed on people that there are some people in the world not worthy or capable of ruling a state. If we ruled a state before we knew of their existence, without these social agencies that he had to have to take up for the defect and his civilization, if no one found any hunger in Africa, whatever condition they were in, they had enough to eat, enough to wear, a place to stay. At the same time, Europeans were eating out of a garbage can if they could find a garbage can. Now, once your mind fails to grapple with your enemy's condition, it also fails to grapple with your condition. Now, you see, in Africa right now, yonder, a state where at least 500,000 Africans were supposed to be killed. But you won't deal with how the Belgians and the French set that up. Deal with how the English, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French engineered walls between one Africa and another. Get guns from one set of Africans to protect themselves from another and ended up enslaving both. You won't deal with that, and yet you're quick to say, you have to control us into slavery. Let's get one thing clear. Slavery was a three-continent industry requiring a revolution in the building of ships and trade, international commerce. The Africans did not have that connection. No matter what the African did or did not do, he could not have brought off an enterprise like this. In the system, servitude in Africa, families were not broken up. A period of servitude, you could go home. You could also marry into the very family in which you was in servitude. There is no comparison between what happened to the Africans and the Africans between themselves. There may not be any justification for it either, but in no way can it be compared. The 300 years of the draining of people from a continent and the creation and an African frame of mind that made him forget he was once the master of the state. This is why in Africa of today you've got a missionary trained, European trained puppets with African bodies and European minds. They have not reclaimed the state and its resources. It's been too many generations since Africans saw Africans ruling a state and ruling it exceptionally well. Years this happened after the fall of Rome, after the rise of Islam. For 1,000 years, Africans ruled independent states in West Africa and down the coast of East Africa, great civilizations, one after the other. We have studied Mashongo, the state that became the Congo. We have not studied the great states of East Africa. Father built by the Africans and the Arabs, been always destroyed by the Arabs, that slave trading. We have not studied the destruction of the physical state and the destruction of the state frame of mind. And we have not studied the Bible as one of the great propaganda media in history. Because people impose things on you in the name of God. So they have taken your image out of the literature of that religion. Look in the Bible as I did earlier before I was 10 and ask the question, why are all the angels white? If God is just, God is kind, he couldn't let one little brown or black angel sneak in hell. So then what you got to do is what competent scholars have already done. Dr. Ben has already done it. James Jackson has already done it. He read the history of Bible writing and Bible changing. But any dictator in Europe can have the Bible rewritten to his will. Then you pick up the same Bible. It must be true because the Bible says it. It must be true because some dictator changed it to suit his will. Now, I'm not telling you to go away from anything. I think Christianity is a dynamic something that you have misused. I think Islam can be dynamic, but I don't think it is. I think Christianity can be dynamic, but I don't think it is. The Baptist Church takes up more money than six small European nations. They don't own a supermarket. They don't control any school. They don't even control the block where the church is located. Because you have not asked the simple question, leader, where are you leading me? And when am I going to get some accountability for the money? I don't think a single thing happened in the march in Washington that couldn't have happened without a march. Now, if some good came out of it organizationally, use that good. If some awareness came out of it, use that awareness. But that's the same thing we should have been doing all along. Even without a march, we should have to be told to adopt our children because when they're being adopted by whites, they'd be programmed into confusion. We should have to be told that. Nobody needs to march to get that point across. And nobody needs to march to bring up the question of atonement as though black women came over on separate slave ships, separate auction bus. We both suffered together. Either we both got something to atone for, or neither one of us got anything to atone for. And that should have been the ideological base in the first place. All right, now, I maintain that the great age of state reclamation recall for the state was the 19th century, both in Africa, the Caribbean islands, and in the United States. Now, let's look at this attempt to state building and how missionary trained Africa ultimately misunderstood Europe's intentions and called on Europe accept some consciousness and lift the burden on Africa, not knowing that where power is concerned then and now, where power is concerned and where they have to maintain it, the European has no consciousness. You're like calling on a rabbit to return a piece of lettuce.